I would definitely put it in the top 10.
It's so good.
A lot more thought has gone into the story.
I think it's awesome.
This is a spy movie disguised as a superhero movie.
There's such clear-cut good and bad.
It's definitely got some horrific elements.
Well, once we go there, you're just going to throw physics out the window.
That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works.
This is like the Fast Times at Ridgemont High of the fantasy world. Yep. Wow. That was something else. Now, kids, your homework tonight is to go home and watch this on television.
At that point in the script, you're actually rooting for her.
And I am just giggling maniacally through the whole thing.
When slashers came home.
I love that they just throw you in there and say, okay, find your way out. A lot of people don't like horror movies.
It's a coming of age, not a horror movie.
But I still love it because it's a slice of life, and I'm okay with that. Tim really wants to like this movie.
I loved the production design.
I wanted more from this movie.
Your reality is not what you think it is.
Oh my God, am I destroying our podcast?
I wish she were mine. Every time I look at her, I wish I had just such a little girl.
This has been a terrible tragedy for Mrs. Daigle as she's lost her only child.
Give me those shoes back.
Oh, no, I got them shoes hid where nobody but me can find them.
Better give me those shoes. They're mine. Give them back to me.
I believe you did it.
Did you have anything? I don't care how small it was. Did you have anything to do with the way Claude got drowned?
What makes you ask that, Mother?
Now look me in the eye and tell me the truth, because I must know.
No, Mother, I didn't.
You're not going back to the Fern School next year. They don't want you anymore.
Okay.
I'm going to call Miss Fern and have her come over here.
You think I lied to her?
You did lie to her.
But not to you, Mother, not to you. Why do you look at me?
I just want to see your face.
Hello and welcome out there in podcast and YouTube land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys. This is a podcast and a YouTube entire network where two guys get around and we talk about science fiction, horror, key influences on a particular topic of the week, and then things that that topic may have influenced moving forward. Sometimes we ramble along. Sometimes we chat up on other topics or go off on tangents or do all kinds of stuff. That's just the way we roll, because we've been doing this since ancient times, since the old ones walked the earth, since there was a firmament, whatever a firmament
since
might be.
Since Cthulhu rose from the ocean.
Since Cthulhu, yes. My name is David. I'm here with Tim. If you are joining us for the first time, we'd love to hear how you found out about us. So maybe leave a comment down below. Always leave us a review because that helps and everything. Let us know how you heard about us. And if you're rejoining us, you know everything that I just told you because you've heard it all before. We say semi-quasi same type of rhetoric every beginning of a podcast, even though we are unscripted. But as I was saying, I'm David. I'm here with my good friend Tim. We've been doing it for a while. Tim, we start off with an icebreaker. What'd you do this week? Did you do something fun?
Well, before we get there, you said something about us doing this for a long time. And I was going to point out that actually we've been doing the show now for 7 years.
Yeah.
We've been talking about movies between ourselves for years.
Yeah, so. 7 years. Yes.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, icebreaker topic. What did I do in the horror world this week? Well, I watched a little movie called Birth Rebirth, which is a strange title. Not my title of choice for what was a really, really good movie.
Oh, okay.
This one came out in 2023. I wasn't prepared for it to be that good. And it's a slow burn, which I like. But everything about this film works for me. The writing, the direction, the cast, et cetera. It's written and directed by a woman named Laura Moss, who has only done shorts and things I've not heard of. So she's relatively new. The cast is strong, though, and features women we have definitely seen before, but you might not be sure where, including Maren Ireland, who was on the show Homeland and in the recent Stephen King movie, The Boogeyman. Judy Reyes, if she doesn't sound familiar, she was a regular on Scrubs, so you would recognize her from that.
Okay.
And she was also in Smile, the recent horror movie that came out a few years ago. And a woman named Brita Wool, who was in Mr. Mercedes and The Walking Dead. Okay. So like I said, these are like character actors that you've seen. You just might not remember where. A synopsis is a morgue technician successfully reanimates the body of a little girl, but she must harvest biological materials from pregnant women to keep the child breathing. When the girl's mother, a nurse, discovers her child is alive, the two enter into a deal that forces them both down a very dark path.
Seems like an X-Files episode.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I don't think it could have been an X-Files. It's a little bit more gruesome than...
Well, yeah, I'm sure, but... But I just meant that kind of premise of, no, I've got to keep feeding my baby, you know, sort of.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole thing. It's like, you did what to my child? But she's alive? So you've got that duality there. You know, mm-hmm. This is wrong, but my kid's alive. The movie gets 95% on Rotten Tomatoes with 96 reviews. I was captivated. It is a completely original story, yet it harkens back to classic horror, namely Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. I highly recommended it. I've added it to our list, and I may even shortlist it for next season just because of the influences there. So, yeah, it's a good one. Check it out.
Okay. Interesting. And what was the name again?
Birth Rebirth.
Birth Rebirth. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'm finally commenting on the fact that I watched Monster, the Ed Gein story,
mm-hmm.
on Netflix. This was the Ryan Murphy series, and Ian Brennan, who I'd never heard of before, but obviously I had heard or should have heard of before because he's the guy that did Glee.
Just Ryan Murphy also.
Right. And the juxtapose, this is a series on Netflix, or a multi-series series, I guess?
Well, they've done another season with Jeffrey Dahmer. So right. It's like a serial killer series of some kind.
Yeah, which is kind of the way they're presenting it, is that each season will be a different serial killer and looking at them from different perspectives is what IMDb says, or the way they try to describe
it. That's because he doesn't stick to the truth.
Correct. There are some just no – I was curious – I wasn't curious about the Dahmer one so much, so I didn't watch it. But I was curious about the Ed Gein one, especially since he inspired so many, from Texas Chainsaw to Psycho to all of it. And this series is very hit and miss, which is what I hear is kind of true of Ryan Murphy overall. I haven't watched a lot of American Horror Stories, which is also his. I've watched – some episodes per season after the second season, but I haven't watched it, I'm sure, as much as you probably have or whatever.
I kind of gave up on it around the fifth season, I think, and there's like 11 or something now maybe, and spinoffs. But
I would, and I think I mentioned it offline to you a few weeks ago or whatever, I would definitely recommend that you watch this particular season if you didn't watch Dahmer or whatever. The performances are pretty outstanding in it. They are really well done and really amazing. Laurie Metcalf is great in it. And the other one that Hunnam, whatever. Anyway, he plays Ed. The photography, and from what I understand, almost every episode, looking back, every episode was written and or directed by Ian Brennan. So I didn't see Ryan's name all over this one. I saw a lot of Ian. And if that's the case, Ian is a pretty twisted dude. We know that Ed Gein was twisted, mm-hmm. but the way he chooses to tell this story and as how graphic it gets in places is pretty extreme.
I was listening to another podcast that was talking about it the other day, and I don't know if this is true because I haven't done my research, but apparently Ed Gein only killed two people, and then he kills a lot more in this or something.
They only charged him with killing two people. Okay. But there was, it's kind of like the whole John Wayne Gacy thing. They only charge him with 8, but they find 25 bodies.
Okay. And this podcaster could have been talking out his ass because I know him.
Yeah. So. Yeah. They only charged Ed with 2, but there were many thoughts that he had multiples, like a brother that disappeared. Okay. Sort of thing.
Yeah, and his was kind of odd because it was very random too. Like it could be, he could have a motive or it could just be somebody dropping by or something from what I understand.
Right. Yeah. Or he's about to get busted off of something else or
okay. Yeah.
Which caught is very for Ryan something Murphy. Else.
Yeah.
Yeah. The unique thing about it I think you would like is, like I said, the description says it looks at each serial killer from different perspectives. This one will suddenly jump forward and show Anthony Perkins on the first day of set for Psycho. And it tells his parallel story. And then it'll suddenly jump and it'll be Toby Hooper trying to do the whole scene with the bucket and the hammer from Texas Chainsaw.
Yeah, that's a great scene.
And cut to outside and the girls talking about how the set stinks and this is horrible and yada yada and all this. And it's very interesting how that parallels the way he's tried to tell the story. But I recommend it. I don't totally agree with how disjointed I felt watching it. In other words, how I've kind of talked about, those of you who listened to me in the past know about like Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. I will never watch that movie again.
Oh, yeah, that you will, because we'll do it.
You know, it scarred me for life sort of thing. And Ed wasn't that bad, but it was close. Ooh, it was pretty.
Next year we'll do Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Oh, yeah. God, no.
Well, I like some of Ryan Murphy's, but then again, a lot of his stuff is – I think almost sensationalism movie making, where his latest has Glenn Close and Kim Kardashian in it. I'm like, really? You know? No. Stop casting your friends. It's okay if you cast good actresses, you know?
Right.
I don't know. Anyway. Well, it's very interesting that I was talking about monster children and you're talking about monster killers because...
We got one.
We've got an interesting topic today. A few seasons back, we decided not to just venture always into horror and always into sci-fi. We started to expand a little bit into fantasy and into suspense. And this would definitely, I think, cross over into suspense because of when it was made. However, the topic is pretty horrific. And it's a little movie that came out in 1956 called The Bad Seed.
Mm-hmm.
Let me do a synopsis and then we'll get going because I'm ready to go. Good. Basically, it is the story of a family, a man and a wife and their daughter. They're the Pinmarks. The daughter's name is Rhoda. And the father is off on some kind of military work kind of thing. He is away from the home. And you've got this seemingly perfect little girl before kissing him goodbye. And then their neighbor, Monica, drops by. She's actually the landlord because it's an apartment building. And, well, during a conversation with Monica, she overhears Rhoda being disappointed of having lost, was it a spelling competition? It was some kind of competition at school.
Yeah, the spelling medal.
Yes. And then later on, Rhoda is at a lake function with her class, and the little boy who won the competition drowns.
Mm-hmm.
We have the teacher. It plays out a lot like a play. It's a lot of it's set in the same room. The teacher shows up saying that she saw Rhoda grabbing for the pin or the medal that the spelling bee medal that the kid was wearing. And so that starts putting the idea in, what is Rhoda's mother's name? I can't remember her name.
I can look at notes real quick.
Yeah. Anyway, her mother starts thinking, well, that's strange. And then the mother of the child that dies is drunk and she shows up thinking that perhaps Rhoda might know something about what happened. And you've got a good scene with Eileen Heckhart. There.
Christine is the mom.
Christine, yes. Christine Penmark and Rhoda Penmark are the main characters. Then, oh my gosh, I need to pull up my notes because I don't want to. Then there's a brief subplot of Christine meeting with her father, who happens to come by and visit, Rhoda's grandfather. And she learns that something she had always suspected, that her mother wasn't really her mother. And he reveals that her mother was actually a notorious Australian serial killer. Mm-hmm. So she starts thinking, did my daughter do something horrible? And is it because it was genetics? And you've got this whole argument of nurture versus nature going on, which is basically the whole theme of this play slash movie. Who dies next? I can't remember.
Or the next death would be the Leroy, the handyman.
Okay. Yeah. What happens is Rhoda has these tap shoes, and she's trying to hide them, isn't she? At first, I think she's trying to hide them. Her mother finds them. They notice that there's this crescent shape from the tap mark, and there was a weird crescent shape found on the boy's head that had drowned. Mm-hmm. So she starts suspecting that Rhoda killed this boy with her tap shoes, and she has Rhoda burn the tap shoes. But this is after she finds the metal, too. She finds the metal hidden in like a jewelry box. So mm-hmm. she starts all of a sudden realizing, oh, my God, my daughter has killed some kid. Mm-hmm. And then as Rhoda is burning the shoes, the handyman of the building starts getting suspicious, too. And he's always not liked her anyway. And so he starts taunting her. And then all of a sudden he ends up in his little hovel down beneath in the, I guess, the basement apartment where the furnace is.
Yeah.
Rhoda sets it on fire. Or, well, it is on fire. We don't know that Rhoda set it. And he gets burned to death and mm-hmm. goes running out. You don't see it. It's off camera. But he's apparently aflame. And Monica and Christine see it from their window as he dies. And by that point, Christine is like, I am at my wit's end. I don't know what to do. So she basically gives Rhoda a bunch of pills and tells her that she threw the metal out in the lake because it needed to be with the boy that died in the lake.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the boy is not still in the lake because they found the body. But she gives Rhoda a bunch of pills. She goes to her room and shoots herself. But the neighbors hear the shot. They both get rushed to the hospital, and neither one of them die. And at the very end, well, you have Christine still in the hospital, and then you have a scene where Rhoda is being pensive about wanting to inherit a lovebird from Monica, and then she realizes from her father, I think it is, that lovebirds don't live very long, and she starts speculating how much longer Monica will live because she wants to inherit that bird, which basically just sets up the next murder. And she goes out to a pier in a goes out to the pier at the lake during a thunderstorm because she wants to find that damn metal, and she gets struck by lightning.
Yep.
Which is a very Deus Ex Machina ending and a very studio ending, which we'll get into as well. Sorry, sure. I didn't mean to ramble so much. I probably should have read just a flat synopsis.
No, that at least is all the high points of everything yes. that happens.
Basically, what we have is a little psychopath. She has no sense of morality whatsoever. And if it's something she wants, she's willing to kill to get it.
Yes. Yes.
And she's supposed to be 8. And she was when she starred in the play, because basically they use virtually the same cast that was in the play in the movie. And she's 10 in the movie. So they kind of dress her down a bit. And it's a little ridiculous with the ponytails and stuff.
Yeah, I have in my notes 5. 5 of the cast members were original cast members from the Broadway play.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. 6. 6 actors from the Broadway show appear in the movie.
Yes, and a lot of them went on to either be nominated for awards or actually won awards.
Right.
Christine won a Tony for this, the woman that plays Christine. I can't think of her name right now. What is your history with this property? Because I am fascinated with this property.
I had read the play, actually. It was in a compendium play of like the 10 best thrillers of the 20th century sort of thing. And I think Night Must Fall was in there, which was the first psychological thriller ever put
on
stage.
And a play that you and I have done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Bad Seed was in there. Children's Hour was in there, even though I don't consider Children's Hour a thriller at all. As a matter of fact, it's very key influence-y kind of to this play. But
it is, because it has a very manipulative little girl in it.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
But so I had read it before. I've never read the novel. And this is only my second time seeing the film. And I did not see the remake, which I heard was really bad from what I read. So this was only my second time watching the movie itself.
Opinions on either or?
I really enjoyed, I like the whole movie, really, because I like the feel of it. It feels like you're watching Harvey. It feels like you're watching a play that's been filmed kind of thing. Almost like Dial In for Murder is shot and done and everything. So I really like it. I do wish they had stuck with the play ending. Instead, they kind of modified and went back to the novel ending and doing research, because it kind of, like you said, it's kind of a deus ex machina at the end, and it doesn't really, it seems like they're trying to save face. And in research, that was basically done because of the PCA and their rules, and you can't have a villain win and all that kind of stuff. Even down to the way they did the totally hilarious credits sort of thing.
Oh my God, they're so bad.
Yeah.
Well, it's a curtain call. And then at the very end, Christine goes out for her bow and Rhoda comes in and she yanks Rhoda across her lap and starts spanking her.
Yes, as they giggle with each other.
Yeah, because murder warrants a spanking.
Because we were just doing a little show for you people. Don't be afraid.
It's pretend.
It's pretend.
You know. Oh my gosh. Well, that kind of makes me want to talk a little bit about the background, because this was a hot property in the mid-50s.
What about you? Had you seen it before?
I have.
Okay.
I can't even remember the first time I saw it. I'm sure it was probably on videotape in the 80s.
Okay.
My guess. And then I don't know if I had seen, I may have seen it multiple times, but the last time I remember seeing it was a couple of years ago when I decided we should do it for this show. And then again, I watched it the other night.
Okay.
The book came out in April of 1954.
Mm-hmm.
The play came out in December of 1954. And the movie came out in September of 1956.
Yep.
That's fast.
Yeah.
That's fast for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess Warner Brothers just was like, this is a hit play. Let's make it happen.
Yeah, do it now. We got time. Do it.
Yeah.
Quick.
Yeah. And basically they hired Mervyn LeRoy. Mervyn LeRoy directed it.
Yeah.
He's not a thriller director. He's a mainstream director. He did Mr. Roberts, Little Women, Gypsy, The Green Berets. Kind of a man's man. Did a lot of military. He was good friends with John Wayne, which is why he did The Green Berets.
Yep.
He's directed 13 different actors to Oscar-winning performances. Or no, Oscar-nominated performances. Excuse me.
Yep.
I've got little notes on him. He was credited with renaming Judy Turner as Lana Turner. He introduced Ronald Reagan to Nancy Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not the first person offered this film. Alfred Hitchcock was. But Alfred Hitchcock turned it down. This feels like an Alfred Hitchcock movie. I think he could have done it better, actually.
He probably would not have shunned on the ending. You know what I mean? So, because in the novel, it ends very similar to this. They both live in the novel, although we don't know if the mother will ever recover from her coma, sort of thing. In the Broadway play, it's got one of those great endings where she gives her the pills, she watches her fall asleep, she picks her up, takes her into one bedroom, she goes into the other one, we hear the gunshot,
mm-hmm.
There's the huge pause, the neighbors run down, they scream seeing the mother, but they rescue the daughter.
and she lives.
I think she'll make it, and they go to curtain. And you go, oh, my God.
Yeah.
She did all of this for nothing kind of thing, mm-hmm. and it's great.
Yeah.
I think this ending with the letting the mom live and—
The whole lightning strike is hilarious to me.
Yeah.
It always has been. I've always thought, oh, she's so evil that God just struck her with lightning.
Yes. Yeah. Right. And like you said, backstory, what I have in my notes is that that was a huge script change that came from the PCA rules that they said they changed it because bad actions in a movie must be punished.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
And that was like was that a precursor to the rating system?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. And I think it was an offshoot of the Hayes Commission. The Hayes Commission was the big one in the 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. And then the PCA came about in the 50s. And that's when Hitchcock had a lot of trouble with them as well. Mm-hmm. And the ratings board. And then in the mid 60s is when they came out with the ratings letters.
Yeah. William March wrote the novel. Maxwell yes. Anderson adapted the play. And then John Lee Mahan did the screenplay for this movie, which is very spot on. And one of the reasons why a lot of people, especially critics, have problems with this movie. Mm-hmm. And that is that Mervyn did not change much from the play and the way actors act on stage. And it's a little melodramatic. It's actually a lot melodramatic when you consider Christine. And he got a lot of flack for that.
But it was kind of a style at the time, though. Go back to 29 and Scarlett O'Hara overacts. Come on now, sort of thing. So it was a style, I think, up until mid-60s, probably.
Oh, you're such a scoundrel.
Yeah. And people literally biting their fingers and stuff and yeah. freaking out. And there's an elevated quality to the acting in a lot of these early black and whites and early drama films.
Yeah, yeah. I mentioned the Broadway production by Maxwell Anderson. It ran for 334 performances, and Nancy Kelly won the 1955 Tony Award. They all recreated their parts. Well, Patty McCormick, Nancy Kelly, Eileen Heckart, Evelyn of Arden, and Henry Jones and Joan Croydon all recreated the role. They just basically took the play to Hollywood mm-hmm. and filmed it. It was one of Warner Brothers' biggest box office hits of 1956. So not only was it a big book and a big play, it was a big movie. It was one of their larger hits, earning the company $4.1 million in theatrical rentals in the U.S. against $1 million budget. It finished among the films the year's top 20 at the box office and among the 10 most popular box office draws in Britain in 1956 as well. So both countries, it did really well in both English-speaking countries. Before I move on to cast, did you have any other thoughts or about the production or the adaptation or anything?
Yes, I think what I really like about the production and the way he did it, though, was he didn't shun from saying that this is a big nurture versus nature debate sort of thing. I read in some reviews and people thought it was very cliche that, oh, so and she just happens to be adopted and her mother just happens to be a serial killer. But I don't think it's just happens. I think that's intentional in the script that the mother's angst comes from the fact that she feels guilty like it's her fault. Mm-hmm. Like she has genetically manipulated her daughter into this monster. Without that, I don't think you would have her hiding stuff from the landlady like she does and lying and not telling her husband and all this guilt and everything that she has unless you have that subtext. If you didn't, it would just be she's a bad mom. You know, she's letting her daughter get away with everything, you know.
Well, they kind of do when you, in that opening scene, they are doting on that little girl a lot. And it's a little nauseating.
Oh, again, I think that's part of the point, so to speak. But,
right.
But I kind of liked her dad and her having this kind of mystery between them, this secret.
I know why you like her dad.
Why?
Because he's in that Praying Mantis movie.
Not her dad. Not Rhoda's dad. Christine's dad. The grandfather.
Christine's dad. Okay.
But yes, you're right. He is in Deadly Mantis, one of the most underrated big-eyed monster movies. But yes. So yeah, I liked the whole nurture versus nature thing. And to your point, yes, I do think Hitchcock might have expanded on it in a different way and done it better. Were there scenes that really stuck out to you? Other than the lightning scene?
Well, Eileen Heckart's drunk scene is amazing to me. I think she's great.
Which one? The first one or the second one?
I think it's the second one where she's even more distraught.
Yeah. In the second one, though, I was going, okay, and it kind of goes back to my point I just said, because if I was the mother or parent of this child, there is no way, A, I would let that drunk lady in my house, no matter how polite society needs to be, and definitely would not let that woman hug my child and sit and have a conversation with her. Mm-hmm. No way. But Christine feels so guilty, like, I've got to do something because I feel so responsible for this woman's horror she's doing, losing a child sort of thing. But yes, her performance, both scenes, outstanding.
Yeah. She just phenomenal. And I like the guy that plays the handyman. He's a very familiar face, very familiar character actor.
Oh, yeah.
I love just that little scene when she comes skipping out of the house and he takes that hose and squirts her.
I thought you would like that scene. Yeah.
Because that's exactly what I would have done. And then she would have killed me.
And the big Excelsior plant when he's suddenly gathering up all this straw and saying, and she knows, I know you sleep on that down in the basement. And I was like going, yeah, sure. Yeah, I like the way, almost like a play, so good and bad. Yeah, some of their blocking is very play-like in this and feels like almost like they're doing a play. But also, I kind of like the fact that he could have had the opportunity to show this guy on fire and or a fire, and he didn't. It's all seen through what Christine sees and how it affects her. I thought that was very, very good.
It is, but it's a little melodramatic because they're looking and seeing it outside the window, and I'm like, it doesn't seem as bad as they make it out. But he does actually die.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned about it being like a play, because most of it is set in their living room, and it is Rhoda and Christine, and the father enters, and then the teacher enters, and then the drunk woman enters, and then her father enters. It's like who's going to come by next?
Yeah. Here's the roll call.
As the story evolves. What else did I have? Oh, well, you mentioned about the endings being different. Warner Brothers notes for the film reported that three endings were shot in a 1955 article in the Los Angeles Times. The end of the film was kept a secret, and the last five pages of the script were not distributed until ready to shoot.
Nice.
And then Mervyn, to, I think, appease the ratings people, added that little spanking at the end.
Of course.
That was his idea.
Yeah. Yeah, to give it even more of a, we don't want you to leave all scared or freaked out that your child might be a psychopath. Yeah.
Might.
Yeah.
And that she lives on. Well, she doesn't live on in the movie. She gets struck by lightning. I just lost my train of thought, but I can move on to cast.
Sure.
And I have them listed. Actually, I guess they're listed out of popularity. I don't know, because they're not listed the way you would think they'd be listed. Like the Rhoda would be first when she's actually almost last on my list.
Oh, okay.
Gage Clark played Reggie Tasker.
Mm-hmm.
Jesse White is in this movie as well. He plays Emery. Jesse White, for those of you that don't remember, was the Maytag man.
Yep.
From 1968 into 1989. He was a very, very predominant character actor in 60s and 70s television.
Very.
And all the way into the 90s. He was on Seinfeld as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Joan Croydon played Miss Fern. She's the teacher with the real severe hat.
Yes.
And then William Hopper, as I mentioned, played Colonel Kenneth Penmark. We know him from this podcast because we did the Deadly Mantis back in like season two. I think it was before we did. Was it before video? I can't remember. He's also in 20 Million Miles to Earth.
I have to edit this.
When he comes back. We did that as well. Did we not? I'm pretty sure we did 20 million. We did 20 million miles to Earth, right?
Yeah.
He is this. I mentioned this when we did Deadly Mantis. He's the son of actress turned gossip columnist Hedda Hopper. So that's his big claim to fame, really, when you think about it, because I think Hedda's a little bit more well-known than he is.
Oh, yeah. Very. Still.
Yeah. Paul Fix played Christine's dad, Richard Bravo. He's a very familiar Western actor.
Very.
Many cowboy movies, including Red River, Giant, and El Dorado.
Mm-hmm.
Henry Jones is the handyman that I mentioned that lives in the basement.
Leroy,
exactly. He's another one of those television actors from the 80s. However, before then, he was doing Hitchcock movies like Vertigo. Mm-hmm. But he was also in modern, well, what I would consider a modern movie, like The Grifters, which came out, 20-something years ago.
Yeah.
Angelica Houston. So he's been, a lot of these people are very prolific actors. If you look at their resumes on IMDb, they did a lot.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Evelyn Vardon was Monica Breedlove. I remember her because I recently watched The Night of the Hunter, which is supposed to be a really scary Robert Mitchum movie, which to me wasn't very scary at all.
Yeah.
It's got Shelley Winters in it, too. Eileen Heckart plays Mrs. Hortense Daigle. How's that for a name? Hortense Daigle.
Yes, Hortense. No wonder she drinks.
I just love her. It's like she's like the predecessor to someone like Allison Janney. She's like, she reminds me of like an Allison Janney actress type. She was in Butterflies Are Free with Goldie Hawn. She was on the show Sybil when Sybil Shepherd was doing that show.
Mm-hmm.
Not too terribly long ago. She is predominantly a stage actress though. Her two appearances in this movie, when she comes in all drunk and grieving.
Both times.
Exactly 1 hour apart. Mm. 36-minute mark and the hour and 36-minute mark.
Interesting.
I just wonder if that was intentional or if it's the same way in the play. I don't know. It's just weird.
That's just some unique trivia. Maybe it's an act two, one and an act two appearance.
If you want to get even more mathematical, they're both exactly 5 minutes long.
Mm.
So she has 2 5-minute scenes in this, and she was nominated for an Academy Award.
Yeah, as she should have been. Yeah.
Yeah. Patty McCormack plays Rhoda Penmark. She actually continued working too, but mostly in television.
Yeah.
And then she's done several, remakes and spinoffs where she played the mother in another Bad Seed or what have you. She's been connected to the Bad Seed a lot her entire life, which kind of makes sense.
Yeah, of course.
Typecast. And then lastly, Nancy Kelly played Christine Penmark. Mm-hmm. Now, she was definitely a stage actress. This was her final film. She, despite earning an Oscar nomination, like I mentioned, she never made another theatrical movie, only focusing on television projects.
Hmm.
It says, apparently, director Mervyn LeRoy did little to persuade Nancy Kelly to modulate her performance. And this is what I was talking about. Rather than simply recreate her stage presence, which is a little bit overplayed for the screen.
Well, and to that extent, so is Patty McCormick as Rhoda.
And so is the drunk, too.
Yes. Yeah.
Look at that picture behind me.
Mm-hmm.
She looks like Julie Louise Dreyfus in Seinfeld or something.
Yeah, she's this close to going into what Dudley Moore character.
Yeah. And it says that a lot of her gestures and movements have an exaggerated stagey quality.
Yes.
However, she was not the first considered for this role, even though they were bringing the play to Hollywood. Rosalind Russell was originally considered. Ooh. But the studio decided to go with the Broadway cast. However, and this is where it gets interesting to me, Bette Davis expressed an interest in playing Christine Penmark, but Mervyn LeRoy insisted on casting Nancy Kelly, who originated the role on stage.
Right.
But Paul Henreid tried to buy the rights to the play, and he wanted to direct it with Bette Davis. And Paul Henreid and Bette Davis have connections in the past with movies.
Okay.
And that's, so it was trying to be developed as a Bette Davis project, but they, Warner Brothers yanked it out from under the rug, yanked the rug out from under them and basically made it the play.
Okay. Makes sense.
But I would have loved to have seen how Bette Davis would have done this role.
Yeah. It also would have been interesting to see her play the Eileen Heckart role too.
She would never do a part that small.
Oh, of course not. Of course not. She would also think that she could play Rhoda. So there'd be that.
In Baby Jane makeup.
Right. In Baby Jane makeup. Here I am with my little pigtail.
Yeah. One other person is in this movie. He's a bit part. Frank Cady plays Henry Daigle.
Oh, yeah.
Eileen Heckart's husband. We know him from not only Rear Window and When Worlds Collide, he was on Green Acres.
That's Mr. Drucker.
It's Mr. Now. Drucker from Green Acres. Yes, it is.
And so. Petticoat Junction. So,
Petticoat
yeah.
Junction. As far as awards, I mentioned this was nominated for 4 Oscars, lead actress Kelly, supporting actress Heckart and McCormack, and cinematography, which is interesting. It was nominated for 2 Golden Globes, supporting actress for Heckart and McCormack, and Heckart won for supporting actress as far as Golden Globes. This movie's not on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die list, and I have beef with that. I think this movie warrants being on that list.
Maybe.
Just think the popularity alone of the property from 1954 to 1956. This was a huge... It's like... Imagine 1990 and 91 without Silence of the Lambs.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be the same thing in 1954 and 56. This would have been that big. And I think it warrants being on the list. So that's my opinion.
And I think thinking about Keys, that you can definitely see that it should have been or should be. Yes, I can see that.
Did you have any trivia? Because I have a ton and I don't want to read stuff verbatim. So...
Well, paraphrase verbatim then.
There are a lot of creepy cameos on the wall, like Rorschach blocks. Did you notice that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those Rorschach blots, the ink blots or whatever.
Yeah.
One in particular is of a woman holding a baby at arm's length. Did you see that one?
Nothing comes to mind, but yeah.
Yeah, it's in there. I looked for it this time and I saw it. It's very strange.
Mm.
What else? More on Robert Osborne in an interview discussing about how Mervyn LeRoy's direction of the film was not appreciated because he didn't tone down the performances, which I have a lot on that.
Right.
However, Osborne praised the film's execution in frightening audiences with its taboo subject matter. And that's another reason why this movie is very memorable, because at the time it was very taboo. You didn't have 8-year-old murderers.
No. And I can understand the nomination from a production angle, the nomination for cinematography, just because even in my notes, I talk about some of the lensing he uses. Times when, like, the landlady's in the foreground and all the way across the room in the kitchen is Christine, and we see them both perfectly. They're framed really well, and it's a unique shot and all that.
Well,
so,
that's
why
it was nominated for cinematography, I'm sure.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah. You mentioned the original ending had Rhoda surviving, the mother dying, but the production code changed that. Don't need to talk about that. Oh, this is an interesting thing. Christine's murderous mother, Bessie Dinker, was invented. All the other female killers or female career killers mentioned in the novel and the film were actually factual.
Mm.
Bessie Dinker is loosely based on Belle Gunness, a Norwegian-born American serial killer who murdered several of her husbands, children, and suitors for their money, insurance policies, and buried the remains on her Indiana farm. She possibly faked her own death and disappeared in 1908.
Great.
If we were just talking about Ed Gein, who was killing people in, the mid-20th century, early 20th century, and this is early 20th century. So
yes.
We just didn't know, but these killers were among us.
Well, and there are other play conventions in it. I see in my notes, like, they drink really, really fast. They'll make a drink, have like two lines of dialogue, and then go, well, I better be going, kind of thing, because I finished my dialogue for this scene. So,
yeah. I think that's all the trivia I have. I glanced over some of it because we've already really talked about it. I have a bunch of keys, though.
Let's do some keys. Why don't we? You have to do the novel first because the novel is what it's based on.
So. The novel and the play are all the result, or all the catalyst for the result.
And to your point, actual female serial killers and their influence. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And I don't know if they were rare or we just didn't know about them.
Right.
Because with social media and the internet, things are found out immediately now. And back then, you didn't know who Ed Gein was until Robert Bloch wrote a book about him, basically.
Yeah.
McCormick starred in the 1995 low-budget film Mommy as a psychopathic mother. She also starred in House of Deadly Secrets in 2018, and some consider both films unofficial sequels to The Bad Seat.
Oh, so I can sort of see that.
How she's tied to it still. She's kind of like Fred Gwynn, who was Herman Munster for the rest of his life.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You got one?
Keys. One of the ones, because I've recently reread Misery and listened to the audiobook and watched the movie, there's several times in the novel where King has Annie, and I don't know what the psychological term is, if anybody's out there watching or listening can tell me, of where you, it's not like blame shifting or projection, but I guess maybe a form of projection, where her defense is, well, I had to kill this cop because I didn't kill the cop. You murdered the cop because you signaled him in the window. And so I had to kill him. It's not my fault. It's your fault. And the same way, because Rhoda says that a couple of times, when she does the confessional about Leroy and when she finally sits down with her mom earlier on and talks about the boy, she said it wasn't her fault that he died. It was his fault because he wouldn't give her the medal. And that's like, that's her justification, really? That's what she thinks?
Right.
So, again, it's psychopathic. But
the mind of a psychopath.
It's there, you know.
Yeah. I've got the first act of the 1992 off-Broadway musical Ruthless is inspired by this film. Are you familiar with that play?
I'm not. No. I'm going to take a note on it, though. No.
I would think it's more like... I would think ruthless people, because she is a ruthless child.
Yeah.
But no. If you want to do a modern equivalent, though, most people out there will remember the 1993 film, The Good Son, with Macaulay Culkin.
Yep.
He played a little murderous child. I didn't see that movie, but I knew it was inspired from this movie.
Little gender swap in there. Yep.
Yeah.
And there was a remake in 85, right?
There was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
it was directed by George Eckstein.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul Wendkos, starring Cary Wells, Blair Brown, Lynn Redgrave, David Carradine, Richard Kiley, and Chad Allen. And it employs the original ending of the March novel and its stage production, but was panned by critics and poorly received by a television audience.
Mm.
That's a good cast, though.
Yeah.
I like Blair Brown and David Carradine and Lynn Redgrave.
I've got the Twilight Zone episode, the one with Billy Mummy, It's a Good Life, which I think is a Matheson one, but it's...
I don't think it is, but it's definitely a Joe Dante one.
Yeah. Well, in the movie version,
definitely. In the remake, yeah.
But because he's a little sociopathic child sort of thing. And we could do all of those. You could do Village of the Damned, even though they're aliens and just kind of odd and weird, but they do... horrible things, and they're little kids.
Because, they're murderous children, and you're very fearful of them because they're British.
But the same thing. Chucky, that's a little murderous. It's not. He's a real psychopath, but he's in a childlike body sort of thing.
So Child's Play, I would have never connected that.
Yeah, all the Chucky franchise kind of thing. Megan's a child murderer.
You're doing robots and dolls now.
Yeah, but they're personifying children who are murderous to me, sort of thing.
So. Oh, okay. I want to put them down.
Well, you don't have to put Chucky, but you have to put Megan, because Megan's a little girl who kills people.
No, she is a robot.
But looks like a little girl. So.
Oh, my God. That's too funny. What else?
What about Omen, then? I've got Omen.
The Omen's a good one, because he is a murderous child. He just happens to be the Antichrist and son of Satan.
Yes, that too, on the side. Yeah.
I've got more that I picked up from IMDb. In June of 2015, it was announced that Lifetime would produce a remake. Reported that Rob Lowe was to direct and star in the remake with McKenna Grace, Sarah Dougal, and Marcy T. Marcy T. House. It's just got a bunch of people. With a special appearance by McCormick as Dr. March. It aired in September of 2018. So Rob Lowe directed a version of this movie. That's crazy.
Wow. Okay.
And I don't know what the name of it was. They must have just called it The Bad Seed, because it doesn't even have the title in here.
Yeah. I'm totally unfamiliar with that one. That one slipped under my radar.
Well, and you don't hear much about Rob Lowe directing.
No.
I'm watching him host game shows.
There you go. I mentioned earlier, make sure it's on the list of Night Must Fall. Just because a psychological thriller of a play version sort of thing, because these were the earliest ones that didn't portray your villain as this mustache twirling sort of just evil bad guy. They kind of blend into society and they're, we actually save them at the end and let the mom die sort of thing. So
I forgot to mention to you, I was going to, because of the play. I know you'd be interested in the play. The play was shortlisted for the 1955 Pulitzer Prize for drama, and it lost. You want to guess what it lost to?
What?
Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Ooh.
Which makes sense. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Literature-wise, I guess. Yes. Makes sense.
But again, hot property.
I have, it's kind of a pseudo key, but it's more of a tone key. This was the era of Twilight Zone, Alfred Hitchcock, all of that. So there was this staged feeling to films and television where they didn't feel like movies. They felt like they were their own entity and kind of overly staged, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't know how to write that down as a key, but yeah.
Yeah, the tone of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. The tone of,
yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking, maybe Twilight that show.
Yeah, specifically the show, not the television show, not the movies.
Do you know when Hitchcock Presents came on? Because I know Twilight Zone didn't come on until 59, but did Hitchcock come on earlier than that?
I thought he was around the same time, starting in 55.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Let me put that down. Alfred Hitchcock Presents. For all you people, I do this so that we have these links on the website for you if you want to check them out.
Yes.
I had one more, and it was another remake or sequel. Hang on a second. Where was that? Oh, 4 years after the Rob Lowe version, a sequel to the Lifetime movie entitled The Bad Seed Returns aired. And it featured McKenna Grace as Emma and Patty McCormack as Emma's therapist. So see how she's always connected to these things?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I'll be in it. I'm still alive.
Yeah.
Only living member from the cast. Yeah.
I have two that may, my last two that maybe you can help me with, because I cannot remember the proper names used in them. One is, there's something wrong with, I think it was like Steve or something wrong with Bobby, whatever.
There's that movie that we need to talk about, Kevin.
That's the other one. We need to talk about Kevin was the other one that I have. But there's another one. There's something wrong with, and it could have been Emily, or for all I know. I can't remember the name. But I remember both of those from the promos. I have not seen those films, but both of those from the promos seem to be about murderous children and how does a family react to it and nurture versus nature and all that.
I know the Kevin movie. You don't know the other one, though?
I don't know the last name. I'll try. I have to look it up.
But, yeah. And I've not seen that movie, but doesn't it have Tilda Swinton in it? I think it does.
Yeah, I think so. It goes back to full circle, back to what I was talking about when I said I watched Ed Gein, because the whole subtext in that series is nature versus nurture. How much of his depravity was genetic, was inspired by the way his mother raised him and treated him and the way people through his early life treated him or mistreated him, sort of thing. There's a lot of that subtext to it.
You just reminded me, I was thinking of Murderous Kids, and I remember a movie, I vaguely remember this, I'll have to look it up and put a link in, but it was a television movie in the 70s called Bad Ronald. I don't remember much about it, and he was more of an adolescent or a teenager, and I think he like lived or could get into the... in between the walls and would like spy on people through like holes in the wall.
Yeah, I vaguely remember something like that.
It was like an ABC movie of the week. It was some stupid trash, I'm sure. But I just remember it was called Bad Ronald. And it was, I don't know if he was a killer though. He must have been because he was bad.
But, yeah, because he's bad. All killers are bad.
So that's but another that's what, one I could think of.
But that's what we think, Tim and I, about this bad scene. I think we both like it. I would recommend it and say watch it. And it should be on the 1001 list and all of that. But we want to know what you guys think. So let us know down below. Leave us a comment. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. That always helps us get new people too, and or your podcast of choice, if you want to review us there. If you like what you see and how we interact and kind of dissect these little things, we have a ton more either down there in the YouTube menu that you're looking at or on your podcast menu. You can go back to multiple seasons and find a movie that you've seen and see if we agree with you or you agree with us. We also have a Patreon where we have a couple of side projects, including an examination of Star Trek, the original series, and the X-Files. We also have some free content there, some merch, there's all kinds of stuff. There's just stuff everywhere that you can support. Johnny Has the Keys, and we would love to have your support.
The merch is on the website, not Patreon.
But oh, yeah, correct. We
have plenty of merch.
You have to go to the website to do that. And Tim, until next time. Next time's a bigger episode. So
yeah.
See you then.
All right. We'll talk to you then.
Bye.